My name's Conrad Chu. I come from the Mount Albert North campus. I'm one of the ministers in St. Hilary's. If you haven't met me before, come and chat with me afterwards. Tonight we are continuing our series in Revelation by looking at the letter to Thyatira, which you just read. Now I understand that you have been looking at the first three letters over the last few weeks. I'm going to take a different approach to the previous sermons. Rather than focusing on the letter today, which I think is very similar to the previous letter to Pergamum, I would like to use today's letter as a case study on how we should read and apply the revelation for our daily spiritual lives. If we're going to take a poll on what most people associate the book of Revelation with, I can guarantee that the majority will say it is full of scary images and symbolisms. As a result, some would prefer just reading the letters because they appear less strange and less cryptic than the rest of the book. Nevertheless, there are still some things in the letters that are not exactly clear to us. For example, in the letter to Pergamum that you read last week, there are no explicit explanation of who the Nicolaitans are and what they taught, or what the throne of Satan was. And with today's letter, we're left in the dark with regards to the identity of the self-professed prophetess, whom John compared with the evil queen Jezebel. And we know she led the Israelites astray to the idolatry worship of Baal. That's all we know about that self-proclaimed prophetess. And neither do we know exactly what the deep things of Satan is. Scholars have speculated, no one knows. Or what the morning star is, which Jesus promised to give to the faithful believers in Thyatira. I can take a guess, it's probably something good. So at best, we can have an educated guess by studying the history and archaeology, but we can never be certain. Despite the efforts of many trying to speculate what all the symbolisms represent in the book, history tells us that only one thing can be certain about the book of Revelation, and that is, no one can be certain about what the symbolisms represent, of how, when, and the end times events will take place. This, in fact, confirms what Jesus said about the end times. But about that day or hour, no one knows, nor even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. Be on guard. Be alert. You do not know when that time will come. So, if we can never be certain about what and when the events in the book of Revelation will take place, does that mean that there's no point for us to read the book of Revelation? Unfortunately, this common assumption that the book of Revelation is all about predicting the end times results in two polarizing responses to it. Those who have an unhealthy obsession to trying to decipher the codes in the book, and those who avoid it like the plague, which I think is understandable because there are literally plagues in the book of Revelation. Now, to set the record straight, the book of Revelation was not written and passed down to us so that we can decipher the codes and predict the world events. In fact, John clearly stated the purpose at his introduction. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show to his servants the things that must soon take place. He made it known by sending his angels to his servant John, who bore witness to the word of God and to the testimony of Jesus Christ, even to all that saw it. Blessed is the one who reads aloud the words of this prophecy, and blessed are those who hear and who keep what is written in it. For the time is near. John to the seven churches that are in Asia. John wrote the revelation because it was meant to be heard and kept. Now, the CSB version, what I just quoted is the ESV version. The CSB version has a superscript next to the word keep, which further explains the word as follow or obey. This word keep is the same word that Jesus used when he exhorted his disciples to keep his commands. If you keep my commands, you will remain in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commands and remain in his love. Evidently, the CSB was right in emphasizing the sense of following or obeying in the word keep, rather than just a sense of treasuring or preserving, which strangely is what the NIV has opted to do by translating it as take to heart. In other words, the main purpose for John in writing the Revelation or Apocalypse that he saw was for the hearers of his prophecy to actively respond to become doers as well. The reason why I highlighted the differences between the different translations is that whilst the word keep certainly has the sense of preserving or treasuring, to restrict it only to that sense seems to imply that our response after reading Revelation only needs to be a mental exercise of keeping it in our hearts. And sadly, this seems to be how some of us have approached the book of Revelation, by taking the symbolisms to heart and use them to label certain people, countries, or events according to our own interpretations and speculations. Clearly, this is not what John had intended for this apocalypse. One of the main reasons that contributed to this confusion is because we fail to appreciate the three different genres that are contained in the book of Revelation and how each genre should be read. In the introduction we just looked at, John clearly informed us of the three different genres, respectively, the apocalypse or Revelation, prophecy, and letter. This slide is probably not showing too well. I intended to show the whole thing. When they start the revelation of Jesus Christ, that's the word apocalypse, that's where it comes from. And blessed is the one who reads aloud the words of this prophecy, the word prophecy, obviously prophecy. And when John said to the seven churches, it means letter. Now, adding to this confusion is the failure to recognize the difference between apocalypse, revelation, and prophecy. Most people think they meant the same thing, that is, a prediction of future events. Whilst this is true that prophecy usually contains some words about the future, the primary definition and purpose of a prophecy is to bring a timely word from God to the people. Accordingly, a prophecy may come as a word of comfort or reassurance. For example, when Israel was being a threat of being invaded by another country, or as a word of rebuke or correction. For example, when Israelites became unfaithful to God and practiced idolatry, or as a word of encouragement or exhortation, for example, when they were on the brink of entering the promised land, or when they were going back to the homeland to rebuild the temple. The future elements in the prophecy are mainly there to support the surety of the message, in order to motivate the hearers to make the right and appropriate responses to the prophetic message. In other words, what makes a prophecy, is the proclamation of an authenticated message from God for the present moment, which usually expects or demands an immediate and appropriate response from the hearers. This means the seven specific messages to the seven churches are in fact the prophecies that they were expected to keep or obey respectively. Now, if you started looking at the letters, we can actually group the instructions to the seven churches into three expected responses. Repentance, either from doctrinal error or immoral practices, steadfastness against temptation, and perseverance in persecution. An apocalypse, on the other hand, is a supernatural experience that the writer has received and recorded down for the purpose of helping his recipients get a glimpse of the spiritual reality that is beyond the world they live in and beyond the time they lived. While there are many prophecies in the Bible, apocalypse or apocalyptic literatures are not so common. The most prominent one in the Old Testament is the book of Daniel. Accordingly, Daniel recorded visions of successive empires and also the famous vision of the Son of Man. These are recorded down as an apocalypse. In his second letter to the Corinthians, Paul only mentioned that he had such an experience, but did not divulge in the details of his vision. Now, even Paul did not write down his supernatural experience. His purpose of mentioning it was the same for John. basically to bolster the claims of authority and authenticity of the God-given message. In other words, even though the apocalypse may give us glimpses of the future, its primary purpose is to give support to the prophetic word. Again, to motivate the hearers to an immediate and appropriate response by giving them a glimpse into the supernatural world and the world to come. When we recognize this important purpose of the apocalypse, it makes it easier to understand the apocalyptic writings of Revelation. Because sandwiched between these horrifying and strange images are repeated calls to repentance, steadfastness, and perseverance, evidently to support the very three purposes of the prophetic words that we have just listed. When we recognize the primary purpose of John's apocalypse was to give support to his prophetic words, rather than to predict the exact timing sequence of future events, the apocalypse will suddenly become more approachable and understandable to us. Finally, the genre of epistle or letter should not be foreign to us, because most of the New Testament, apart from the Gospels, were written in the form of letters. What makes Revelation different to the other letters is that it is a circular letter that is written to seven churches simultaneously, which John obviously expected to be passed around the churches in a clockwise direction, if you can show the map, starting from Ephesus. In other words, rather than writing seven separate letters, which means John would have to repeat the apocalypse seven times, John significantly reduced the labor intensiveness of his work by grouping the introduction and prophecies to seven churches in the first four chapters and attached the apocalypse after them. Depending on what specific prophecies or instructions to each church was, each one of them would be able to find something in the apocalypse that would speak directly to their own situation. In recognizing the book of Revelation is in fact an epistle or letter, or more precisely seven epistles grouped into one, we should read it using the same methods as we would read other epistles of the New Testament. That is, to first find out what it meant to the first recipients of the letter, by understanding the social, cultural, historical background, and then reimagine how these letters may speak to us today. Now we are ready to look into the letter of Thyatira. As I previously mentioned, the letter of Thyatira is very similar to the previous letter, Pergamon, last week. Both churches have participated in eating food sacrificed to idols. The one difference is that Thyatira's compromise was led by a self-proclaimed prophetess, whom John called Jezebel. Obviously, is a reference to the evil queen who led her husband King Ahab and the whole Israelite nation astray by introducing to the worship of Baal. Now, applying our previous definition of prophecy, this so-called prophetess must therefore be claiming to have received a direct message from God to the church in Thyatira, falsely reassuring them it is okay to eat food sacrificed to idols. The other difference is that the history of Thyatira may give us a clue as to the reason why Christians there might be tempted to eat food sacrificed to idols. Thyatira was known for having a lot of trade guilds. The only mention of Thyatira in the Bible, apart from here, is in the book of Acts. One who heard us was a woman named Lydia, from the city of Thyatira, a seller of purple goods, who was a worshipper of God. The Lord opened her heart to pay attention to what was said by Paul. Lydia, this woman here, who was from Thyatira, happened to meet Paul and his missionaries in Philippi and became the first convert from Thyatira. Luke specifically mentioned that Lydia was a seller of purple goods, suggesting that she dealt in the trade of dyeing fabric into purple color, for which Thyatira was famous for producing. Therefore, scholars speculate that the reason why Christians in Thyatira would be tempted to eat food sacrificed to idols was due to their necessary attachments to the various trade guilds that they had to belong to in order to remain and thrive in their trade. I guess it's kind of like our trade unions. The temptation or pressure to eat food sacrificed to idols would happen often at the meetings of these trade guilds, where the food provided would necessarily be first presented to the various gods that they worship before they are brought out to all for open consumption. This is actually the very issue that Paul had to address in 1 Corinthians 8. Similar practices are actually, in fact, still being practiced in Hong Kong, where I grew up. For example, in the film industry, it is common practice that everyone in the film crew, including producers, directors, and actors, will first sacrifice food to the gods before they will start filming. Well, this is a typical film crew. As you can see, some of them are wearing very strange uniform because they are obviously producing a film on ancient China. And there's a suckling pig, which is the Chinese people love eating. That's what they're doing there. And also many restaurants have small altars for the gods that they serve, whom they will offer incense every day before they open for business. You may have even encountered one of those restaurants or things like that. Next time we go to a Chinese restaurant, look out. Now this guy is a famous guy called Duke Guan. Now, well-known fact about worshipping idols in Hong Kong, which people find really amusing, is that the Hong Kong police force and the Hong Kong triads both worship the same god, this guy. Who was a very famous general, known for his combating skills and fierce loyalty to his master. Imagine what a dilemma it would have been for Duke Guan. Now, should he prosper the Hong Kong police force, which means helping them catch the criminals? Let me show the next one. Yeah, these are the Hong Kong police offering the respects to Duke Guan. Or should he protect the Hong Kong triad, who equally faithfully paid him dues and respects? So who's going to help? Bit of a dilemma there. I guess whoever gave him more. Thus, we can see that it can be challenging for some to be Christian in Hong Kong. But what about us in Australia? What are the areas in our lives where we might be pressured to bow down to idols or to make compromise in our faith? One of the scariest verses that I find in this passage is in fact verse 19, which I think is even scarier than horrible images found later in the apocalypse. Can we show that? I know your works, your love and faith and service and patient endurance, and that your latter works exceed the first. Let us pause for a moment to consider the gravity of this comment. The Thyatirans were commended for their works, for their love, for their faith and endurance. And unlike the Ephesians, which you studied 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, who abandoned the first love, these guys, the Thyatirans, were even praised for having greater works than the first. Now, it seems to me they were doing a lot of things right, probably more than I can say about myself. I wonder what Jesus would say to the church, to the angel in Melbourne today, or even to St. Hilary's. Would we even get a commendation as good as this? The scary thing to me is that how can these people who are doing everything so right, yet can have such a huge blind spot in their conscience to what is lacking in the faith? This verse makes me wonder if we too might have an equally blind spot in our faith that we have failed to notice. And if we do, what might that be? Recently, Tavis and Kate have been calling us to reflect on whether Christians should participate in the celebration of various pagan events, including even Mother's Day, God forbid. They've thoughtfully helped us teased out the issues behind and demonstrated that while there are no right or wrong answers, there are right and wrong motives. Whether we participate or not in pagan practices, we need to weigh up for ourselves in our own conscience the pros and cons and intentionally seek God to ensure that we have the right motives and convictions. My personal reflection on this passage on what the huge blind spot could be in my life is not so much about pagan festivals, whether I celebrate them or not, but rather whether we are keeping or not keeping our Sabbath. Now, I'm not entering the debate of whether Sabbath should be Saturday or Sunday, but I'm asking whether we are keeping the spirit of the Sabbath, capital S, whether we're obeying the spirit of the Sabbath. I remember when I first came to Australia from Hong Kong in the 80s, I was shocked to find that most shops do not open on Sunday. Now, being used to the convenience of living in the city where I can eat whatever I want to eat, buy whatever I want to buy, any time of the day, every day of the week, that was a total shock. So you can imagine, I heartily welcomed the Sunday trading being introduced in 1991. It was only 1991. Gee, it felt like for ages that we had it. I would be the first to confess I have enjoyed and am still enjoying this convenience in our lives. But in our acceptance of Sunday trading, have we subconsciously allowed ourselves to participate in eating foods sacrificed to the gods of pleasure and entertainment at expense of the holy day that we should be keeping for the sole worship of our God? Now, I'm not saying that we start protesting with placards to say to remove Sunday trading. But I'm suggesting perhaps we should refrain from participating in partaking these idols. Now, as I said, I'm the first to confess that I do enjoy shopping on Sundays. In fact, my wife would say I enjoy shopping on every day of the week. Therefore, I'm acutely aware that as I make this public confession and reflection, my wife is going to hold me accountable to what I'm preaching today. In fact, I shared this with her last night, and she said, well, remember, no online shopping either. The Christians in Thyatira, for the sake of their jobs, which would be their only means of livelihood, cannot help but belong to the trade guilds. But they still have the choice to refrain themselves from eating food sacrificed at the meeting that had been sacrificed to the idols. While we can no longer turn back the clock on Sunday trading, we can still turn our backs to the practice of Sunday trading by refraining from the pleasure-seeking practices on the holy day and devote our time and minds to the celebration of the Sabbath by keeping or following the spirit of the Sabbath. Now, I know I'm treading dangerous territories here, and I'm still processing this within myself. But if I'm honest to myself and to God, my personal reflection in this passage is that I'm talking about me personally, be more intentional on how I keep my Sabbath. I'm not saying this is a general prescription for everyone. I think each one of us has to seek God to reveal to us what are the areas in our lives that we may have succumbed to the pressure or temptation to compromise. I'll leave that to your own consideration. I only mentioned how keeping Sabbath day seems to be the message for me to show you how I process it and sought to understand and apply this passage to myself through the help of God's Spirit. The bottom line is this. The prophetic word to Thyatira is a good wake-up call for all of us to take stock of our faith. Remember, the Thyatirans were commended for their works, their love, faith, service, and perseverance, and still failed to identify the dichotomy in their lives. In closing, I hope that we make Revelation a bit more approachable, and that we'll be more encouraged to read Revelation more. And I also hope that we have overcome the common assumption that it is just a book written for the future, but rather a book that is just as relevant as all the other books in the Bible for our present lives, that could also help us reflect and grow in our spiritual lives.